The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts. The temple is an affiliate of Boundless Way Zen, a multi-lineage school of Zen Buddhism. So this is the beginning of our series of Dharma talks for this summer session. And the four teachers will be sharing these talks each day. A different pair will present our understanding of the topic that we've chosen for the session. And today, Mike Sensei and I will be presenting our understanding of a koan that is a very fundamental story in our Zen tradition. It's found in three different places in Zen literature. One is in our Gateless Gate koan collection, where it's case number 23. One is in a Japanese Rinzai collection called Entangling Vines, where it's number 2, placed there, I think, because of its importance. And also it appears in a text which is attributed to a 7th century Chinese teacher named Hui Neng called the Platform Sutra. We're not sure that Wei Neng actually wrote the sutra. It may have been written by some of his disciples, maybe even many, many years after he lived. But it's written in the first person, as if it was in his voice. And his voice is an important voice in the teachings of Zen that we've inherited, especially from our Chinese ancestors, because he was the first Chinese Zen teacher or Chan teacher who was not an educated elite member of the upper classes. He was someone who struggled early on in his life just surviving. And according to legend, he never learned to read. So I'm going to read you the version of the story that's in the Entangling Vines collection. And probably over the week, someone or many of us will read the version that's in case 23 in the Gateless Gate, maybe even read a little bit from the Platform Sutra. But in this story, the koan goes like this. The senior monk, Hui Ming, pursued Wei Neng, the sixth ancestor, to Dai Yu Peak. Wei Neng, seeing him come, put the robe and bowl on a rock and said, "This robe represents faith. How can it be taken by force? You may have it." Wei Ming tried to pick it up, but like a mountain, it couldn't be moved. Shaken and frightened, Wei Ming said, "I came in search of the Dharma, not for the sake of the robe. Lay brother, please instruct me." Wei Neng said, "Think not of good, think not of evil at this very moment. What is your original face before your father and mother were born?" Maybe it's the sound of that siren. "At this very moment, what is your original face before your father and mother were born?" At that moment, Hui Ming was deeply enlightened, and his entire body flowed with sweat. With tears in his eyes, he bowed and asked, "Is there any meaning still more profound than the hidden meaning and words you have just imparted to me?" "There's nothing hidden about what I've revealed," replied Wei Neng. "If you turn your own light inward and illuminate your original face, what is hidden is within yourself." Wei Ming said, "Although I practiced with the assembly under Hong Ren, I had yet to realize my original face. Now you have shown the way in. I'm like the one who has tasted water and knows for himself whether it's cold or warm. You, lay brother, are now my teacher." Wei Neng replied, "If that's how it is with you, then you and I are equally the disciples of Hong Ren. Take good care of yourself." So that's the koan, which we'll be exploring over the week. But I wanted to talk first about Wei Nung himself and Wei Ming too a little bit. Who are these characters that we encounter? When we study koans, it's very important to let ourselves sink into them as if they were happening to us right now, in this present moment. Every piece of the encounter is relevant to our lives as not just Zen practitioners, but as human beings on this planet that's full of suffering, in this universe, as someone once corrected me, that's full of suffering. It's really important to know that these people, although they lived 2,000 years ago, almost 1,500 years ago, are just like us in so many ways. And in fact, one of the main teachings of Wei Nung is that no matter what our circumstances, no matter how we identify ourselves, no matter what our background is or the story of our life, we have more in common than we have in difference. And I was particularly happy to see that in the chant we read earlier, which is one of my favorites, The Harmony of Relative and Absolute by another one of our Chinese ancestors, Shi To. He speaks about this directly. He's actually quoting Wei Nung. He says, "Among human beings are wise ones and fools, but in the way there is no northern or southern ancestor." So it's true that we're all unique, and it's also true that we're all in the way the same, because Wei Nung's primary teaching throughout his life and throughout his writing of the Platform Sutra and other records that were kept of him was that there is no such thing as becoming a Buddha. We are already Buddhas. We are already awakened ones. And he used a word in Chinese that that's been translated in various ways, but one way that I like is that there is the potential for awakening in every human being. We don't need to bother with ants and sticks and grizzly bears and dogs and flowers because they're already fully awakened and they don't need to practice the way. But we human beings, we interfere with our own sense of who we are. We think that we are lacking. And here's Wei Nung, who was the son of a pretty highfalutin guy, someone who was part of the government in China. It's possible that his mother was actually not an ethnic Chinese, came from the south where there are many kinds of tribes. He's called a barbarian when he first meets his teacher, and this is a reference not only to his lack of training, but his ethnicity, perhaps. And his father had been thrown out of the ruling class, and his father and mother went to live in the south, away from the northern capital, and struggled, and his father died when Wei Nung was 3 years old, and he and his mother, impoverished, lived in a city in the south of China, where they sold firewood. And this was Wei Nung's humble beginnings. As one commentator says, he knew what it was like to not have a life of privilege. He knew what it was like to be hungry, to be cold, to struggle in his life. And somehow or other, he wasn't beaten down by that, so much so that one day when he was out in the town square selling firewood, and a monk walked by chanting the Diamond Sutra, he heard a line from the Diamond Sutra that so deeply penetrated him that his heart awakened. And he made arrangements to take care of his elderly mother and decided he had to go north to find the way, to find the source. After he talked to this monk, he grabbed him, he pulled him aside, he said, "What is that that you've been chanting?" And the monk explained a little bit about Zen. And Wei Nung's first teacher, it turns out, was a woman, a nun, who he studied with for a while. He studied with a couple of other teachers. He studied for 3 years learning about meditation and Zazen. And then he found his way north to Hung Ren's place, a teacher who had inherited the robe and bowl from Bodhidharma, the original Chinese teacher who brought Zen from India to China. And Hung Ren had an interview with him where he said, "Who do you think you are, you barbarian from the south, coming to me to learn about Zen?" And Wei Nung did not become defensive. He did not quote something from a sutra to show how smart he was. He said, "In the way, there are no northerners or southerners." And this really struck Hung Ren, who decided that this kid had some merit. And he sent him off for 9 months to thresh rice. And there's a wonderful story, which we'll probably tell more details of, about how Hung Ren ended up recognizing Hui Nung as his Dharma successor, his Dharma heir, and he gave him the robe and bowl, but he knew that Hui Nung, as a barbarian from the south, an illiterate rice thresher, woodcutter, would not be respected by the other people in the monastery. And so he sent him away. There's one lovely... it's not in the original sutra of Wei Nung, but it is a little apocryphal story that he himself, the old teacher, rode Wei Nung across the river that separated the south of China from the north of China, and sent him on his way. And Wei Nung apparently went on a pilgrimage for 2 months with the robe and the bowl, hoping that that he could finally, according to his teacher's advice, his teacher said, "Wait 3 years before you start teaching. Hold off until this has already penetrated you so thoroughly that you can be an exemplar." And meanwhile, back at the monastery, we had all of the monks find out about this. All of the people who Hung Ren thought would be upset were upset. They all started chasing after him, crossing the river themselves. For 2 months, they chased him, and one by one they dropped away, as you can imagine, except for this one guy, Hui Ming, who had originally been in the army. He was a general. And he thought he knew what he wanted. He wanted to get the robe and bowl back from the imposter. The story in the koan is when he finally catches up after 2 months of running after him, 2 months of chasing up and down mountains and hills and dales to find this imposter. And Wei Nung just says, "Take it." And that has a transformative effect on the general, Hui Ming, the former general. So this story has so many aspects to it that we thought for 7 days we could probably get something out of it. But what I want to encourage you to do with the stories that you're hearing before I hand the talk over to Mike is to notice if there were any parts of the story that touched your heart, the way Wei Nung's heart was touched by hearing the Diamond Sutra chanted in the square in his town where he was selling firewood. Because this is what's important. You don't have to memorize everything. You don't have to know everything. Someone said to me recently, a new sitter here at the temple, "I'm beginning to get the idea that this is not about accumulating knowledge." I'm beginning to get the idea that this is about dropping and not knowing. This is somebody who's just been sitting for maybe a couple of weeks. Beginner's mind, right? And I said, yeah, that's right. With a little bit of trepidation, firming too early. But yeah, he was onto something. Wei Nung is the first truly Chinese teacher. He's the person who pulled it all together. And we can feel the echoes of his teaching. Everyone has the Buddha nature in our teachings in Boundless Way right up to the present moment. So Mike is going to take this off and say a few more words to illuminate this great story that has been handed down to us over the centuries.
So it's quite a remarkable story, actually, if you think about it. Here, this uncultured, uneducated, very poor person enters the monastery, challenged right at the start, but able to respond with a kind of faith in something that transcended his personal circumstance. There is no northern or southern ancestor in the way. There's just human beings. It's amazing what moved him to make that journey in the first place. Here he is, a young boy just struggling to survive, gathering wood. And here's a line. Now, in the actual Platform Sutra, the line is not recorded, but elsewhere it is translated variously, but one translation goes something like, "Give rise to the mind that abides nowhere." And Hui Neng was so moved by that that he asked his mother if she would support his seeking the Dharma. And off he went, quite young, to practice. And at one point, the fifth ancestor was looking for someone to transmit the robe and bowl, this authority to teach. And so he asked his monks to write poems. And in the Platform Sutra that I glanced over just recently, Hui Neng wasn't even really aware that this was happening. He kind of found out after the fact. He wasn't even invited to participate in a direct way in this poetry contest. And so two poems were written. And the first was by the monk, this senior monk, who wrote a poem that went like this. I'll read it for you. "The mind is the Bodhi tree. The body is the mirror's stand." Oops, sorry, wrong poem. "The body is a Bodhi tree. The mind is like a standing mirror. Always try to keep it clean. Don't let it gather dust." So this is a practitioner who has some experience with practice and is offering a teaching that has a certain kind of value to it. This teaching about, we hear the phrases, cut off the mind road. Here we are not chasing after thoughts. But there is something a little off in this teaching as well. And Hui Neng is aware. So when he sees this poem later, he hears about this poem, he decides to write a response. And his response goes like this. "Bodhi doesn't have any trees. This mirror doesn't have a stand. Our Buddha nature is forever pure. Where do you get this dust?" So then it says, "I composed another one. The mind is the Bodhi tree. The body is the mirror's stand. The mirror itself is so clean, dust has no place to land. So, this was recognized by the fifth ancestor as a superior expression of the Dharma. And this is what led to Huainong receiving transmission and being shooed away from the monastery and told to continue to practice for 3 more years before you teach. And of course, it's as he's fleeing that he is chased down. And that's where the koan begins. So I thought it would be useful to spend some time with this Dharma, with this poem offered by Huainong, as a pointer for us as we practice here together. We might have the idea that we come here to change ourselves, that we come here to remove something that we don't like about ourselves, or maybe about our lives. If I can just remove this afflictive emotion of sadness or anger or shame, then I will be okay. If I can come here and clean the mirror of my heart mind and purify myself, then I will be enlightened. To practice this way, in my experience, is painful. What arises is what arises. And we are not trying to change what is present, but to see what is present, to bear compassionate witness to whatever is arising, and to look closely into our true nature. There is nothing we need to change. There is nobody else that we need to be. Our true nature is already present, manifesting perfectly. It is in our teardrops. It is in our anger. It is in the dust. And so, when the monk finally catches Huainong, at first he thinks, I want the robe. But there is something he can see in Huainong's offering, where he realizes that Huainong is free and he is not, and he wants to be. This for me is a touching moment in the case where that monk says, I too want to be free. Help me. And it's so interesting that Huainong doesn't respond by saying, oh, well, let me lay forth some Dharma for you. He says, who are you? Who are you? Thank you. So, if you'd like to make yourself comfortable, now is an opportunity for us to have a Dharma dialogue, a chance for you to come forth with whatever arose for you in this, whether it's a question or an objection or whatever is here for you. What touched you or didn't touch you?
And just know that this talk is being recorded. So if you don't want to be recorded when you offer your question, objection, or insight, also that's welcome, we will turn it off briefly and turn it back on after you speak.
Yeah.
Thank you both. That was really powerful. Seriously. I'm very moved. But could you both say something about enlightenment, that even all these flaws and these emotions that keep arising, now that also is enlightenment. Mm. Can you please reassure me that it is?
It is.
Next!
Thank you. Yeah, well, it's hard to believe, right?
Yes, it is, very hard.
Yeah. Yeah. And this was the radical teaching of Chinese Zen, really, that we inherited, that was different from Indian Buddhism. Really, really different. In Indian Buddhism, you have to go through stages. Even modern teachers of original Buddhism talk about going through stages. It's just that makes sense, you know. And this is what was his name, Shen Shu, the head monk who was really respected in the monastery by everybody. His poem about the mirror, about that makes sense. And Wei Nung's poem doesn't really make sense. What? There's no mirror? They're all metaphors. But how could... And he elucidates it in his sutra, in these writings. He talks about it, and then, you know, hundreds of years later, Dogen talks about it. All the great Zen masters in the Tang Dynasty and Sung Dynasty in China talked about it. And then it became part of the great vehicle teachings, which were also inherited by the Tibetan Buddhists, that already accomplished. Actually, the Tibetans had their own trajectory that was very similar and overlaps a lot. But this is, it's just so unbelievable, Bill.
Yes.
You know, and I'd like to add that, you know, we have to meet ourselves where we are. So if what's arising for me is that I don't believe it, that's the Dharma presenting perfectly. I don't believe it. This is not enlightenment. I am not it. Right? Okay. So this is what we meet and we look.
Yeah.
So what's this whole thing about improvement? Do we try to improve our character?
Mm. I think...
Or is that also part of enlightenment? To do it or not do it?
You know, I was just telling these guys, a childhood friend of mine just gave me a packet of letters that I wrote when I was in my 20s, 40 years ago.
Oh, wow.
And I finally got up the nerve to read them. There's letters I'd written to her. I couldn't see much difference between the person who was writing those letters and the person who just, the 65-year-old woman who just gave you this Dharma talk. And yet, I'm not that person anymore. Something's changed. I couldn't have given a Dharma talk when I was in my 20s. Mm-hmm. You know, there is... David often talks about growth in compassion and wisdom. You know, there definitely is this ripening. The seed of the flower doesn't stay a seed forever. So it can't help. And this is what Wei Nung says. You can't help but realize your enlightenment. Yeah. But I really want to underline what Mike said. Don't believe any of this. Stay with the disbelief. That's the source of your own awakening.
Alan.
So it
So a moment that's coming up for me in Koan right now is that moment when the military athletic monk, who's sometimes called Myo and sometimes Myo, I can't remember which it was in this version. Is it Myo?
Myo is the Japanese version of the character that are written as Ming.
So Ming catches up after 2 months of running, you know, swimming across the river, running up and down mountains and not giving up. And he puts his hands on the rope, and it's like trying to move a mountain. Mm. Right. So we can take that, if we want, as some miraculous happening. The rope has some... This is Bodhidharma's rope, after all. Has some miraculous power. And I don't think we want to. So the other place I go is, so something has already happened to me. Mm. He hasn't heard a word yet. He's just, you know... That is, and so the question that's coming up for me is there something about just the sheer presence of this lay brother, this teacher, or is it something about those 2 months?
Hmm.
Mm-hmm. Or is he so tired? he has totally exhausted himself, and he would lift it up if he could, but he has given everything away, and nothing's left. Wonderful questions. Mm. So these questions come up and they're all alive and true. And what is it? What's going on in that moment? And for me, it's only when he utterly fails that there's some opening. And usually we want to have success. We want to improve. We want to get what we started. I came to retreat and I have some goals I want to achieve here. I just love how wrong Ming was the whole time, chasing the wrong thing, and in the end he can't even pick up, and in his utter failure there's some freedom.
I was thinking of that same point when Alan said those things. I think of a very specific event, I suppose, and it's I think of like my personal experience when I'm so into like trying to get something, and then I finally get it, and there's almost like this immediate bitter taste in my mouth. It's almost like this disgust, and I don't know if that's at all any component of the koan, but kind of like this strange like reality that I have when the thing I've been chasing for so long isn't fulfilling me, and I finally get to it. And I wonder if you know, what happens to me often is that I just swallow that and I just keep on, you know. But I was wondering if in the story he has the clarity to see that fully, and he doesn't continue to pursue that kind of grasping for this material.
You know, and I like that you have a visceral reaction. You have a bitter taste in your mouth, right? And he starts to sweat, right? That there's almost something embodied, there is something embodied about this, wait, this isn't it. This realization that's body as well as mind.
And I think as human beings, the Buddha called this dukkha. And there is this sense that we are lacking something, and if I just get the next thing, you know, the next electronic, and then we can take it to our spiritual. If I just have a really good experience, you know, if I get a little, let me get a little oneness, that's all I need. And, but the teaching is that since we aren't lacking to begin with, anything we get doesn't make any difference because you weren't lacking anything to begin with. And there are those moments where we sort of get it. And I love what you're saying about the capacity to stay with the bitterness or the disillusionment, to stay long enough that we get melted or something happens to us that we can't contrive. Mm-hmm.
I gotta say too, I just love this guy, Hui Ming, or Ming or Mio, whatever we want to call him, when I first heard this koan, the very first time I heard it from my first teacher in a Dharma talk like this, I think at one of my very first sessions, I just thought, oh man, that's me. I'm constantly running after stuff and then find out, get that bitter taste, find out that's not what I wanted. That's not, and there's something about that spirit running for 2 months. I hadn't really put it together until I did some research that it was 2 months, you know, and he must have slept, I don't know, but whatever the real thing was, it's still a legend. That moment of not being able to lift the robe is one of the turning points of this koan. We've got to feel that for ourselves. What would it be like, this moment, when we think we've accomplished something? I caught him. Mm-hmm. I'm going to get the rope and bowl. Mm-hmm. And then everything just... It's wiped away. Everything is wiped away.
I want to just add one more thing, which you noticed, Samson, which is that a lot of times when this happens to you, you just kind of swallow it and you go on and you look for the next thing to grab onto. And so... how do we not ignore those moments? How do we not swallow them and just push on and do the same thing, try the same thing again and hope that this time it will satisfy? Because that's such a familiar reaction to me.
I think a lot of what I wanted to say has been said, but the piece about it with me is although I really admire Ming's tenacity, that my sense is he's not in charge. We're not in charge of this whole awakening process. Mm-hmm. We can't say it's going to happen, and it can happen to the monk who stayed behind and just sat in his room.
Right? Totally.
And so it's like we think it's got to be something spectacular that moves us through, and yet it's the very ordinariness of our lives that, at least for me, is what's most easily accessible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And even if I chase for something, and I do chase after things, it may happen and it may not. Right? It says I don't have any control over the process. All I have, control over is my intention, right? To live the precepts. And I think that that's, for me, that's the first part of what the monk first monk said is the precepts, the practice. This is what I do. This is what we do here and in my daily life is live the precepts. And, you know, maybe that makes possible something to arise.
Yeah.
And hopefully I will be able to see it. And that's the training, to see it because it's right here.
That's right.
You know, there is this effort, you know, living the precepts, showing up for Sashin, showing up to sit on time when the bell rings, not moving. You know, there's actually a lot of effort in this effortless path of involved in waking up, and there's a lot of a sense of surrender involved in it, and I think also seeing things that we may not want to see, that Trungpa calls it the path of disappointment. I thought this was going to be a lot better than it is. And spending a long time making friends, David, making friends with ourselves, making friends with that disappointment. And okay, so what's here? What's here now?
And you know, the irony of all this is, so this is Wei Nung's Dharma heir is telling a story about their teacher or their teacher's teacher, and from what we can glean from history, the guy who wrote the first poem, Shen Chu, he was the founder of the Northern School of Zen in China. And he was a big deal, and in the story too, the way Wei Nung's, whoever's telling the story, he doubted himself. He's actually got a little bit of the Wei Ming thing. He presented the poem but he said to Hung Ren, the teacher, he said, I think this might be off, and don't give me transmission if you agree with me. Which is really great. I think this may be off. Right? That's so cool. He was a cool character, really a great character. Sometimes he's made out to be a fool, but he wasn't. He was actually the instructor of the new monks in the temple, in the monastery. And then Monk Ming himself became a teacher. and again, in the historical record, it looks like Hongren, the fifth ancestor, had a lot of Dharma heirs. And Wei Nin was just one of them. But all those lines died out. Only Wei Nin's line carried forward into the centuries. So you know, it could be that every single person in that monastery woke up to their true nature and were a blessing to the world. I think we have to think maybe, yeah. And I think you're pointing that out.
Let's say one final thing, maybe, unless anyone else.
Yeah.
So I also really like sort of a theme that's coming up about the ordinariness, where we encounter the possibility of awakening is in the ordinary life. You know, wash your bowl. And I think that this can lead to, there's no such thing as waking up. And that's not... I don't think that's true. I think we can wake up, but it won't be what we expect it to be, ever.
Right. That really comes back to Bill's question. How could it look like this?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And so on that note, let's come back to our Zen posture.